Welcome back. This is KPFK 90.7 FM. This is the Voices from the Frontline segment of the 4 o'clock Public Affairs Hour. This is Tammy Bang Liu, and what we've got here today is in early 1970s, the anti-imperialist struggle in the north of Ireland exploded, following the massacre of 14 unarmed civilians by British paratroopers on Bloody Sunday. The ranks of the Irish Republican Army swelled, and their guerrilla war against the British occupation expanded. Just a few short years, the prisons in the north of Ireland were crowded with IRA volunteers. In 1976, the British government introduced a policy that stripped IRA prisoners of their status as political prisoners. This meant a loss of some rights and privileges within the prison system, but its real aim was to criminalize the entire Irish struggle. They claimed that there was no political motive for the violence in Ireland, and the IRA volunteers were no different than common criminals. Thus began 5 years of intensive protests within the prisons, culminating in a hunger strike in 1981, during which 10 young prisoners died. This Wednesday, May 5th, marks the 23rd anniversary of the first hunger striker's death. Bobby Sands was just 26 years old. So today we have we're very fortunate to have a guest, Dr. Lawrence McEwen, speaking to us from Belfast in the north of Ireland. Lawrence spent over 16 years in prison and was an integral part of the protest, surviving 70 days on hunger strike. He was released in 1993 and now works with COISTA, an umbrella organization for 24 Republican ex-prisoner groups throughout Ireland. He's the author of Out of Time, Irish Republican Prisoners in Loncash, 1972 to 2000. Thank you so much for joining us today, Lawrence.
Hello, Tom, and I thank you for the opportunity.
No problem. And also joining us and helping us out with this segment is Andy Terranova, who's a member of the Labour Community Strategy Centre and a longtime Irish solidarity activist.
Thank you very much.
All right. So, Lawrence, before we start, can you tell us a little bit about what it was like growing up under British occupation in the north of Ireland?
I suppose the very early days, I was born in 1956, and I suppose it's only a later years that when you think back to the type of conditions you lived in. I lived in a house that had no electricity, had no running water. And that was probably the condition of probably a lot of Catholic working class people throughout the whole north of Ireland. Basically, we lived in a state that we had no part of. When it was established, it was said it was a Protestant state for a Protestant people, and that's how it was governed. And but I mean, life in one sense was pretty idyllic. I grew up 20 minutes outside of Belfast, and then wasn't aware of anything at the time. It was early 60s, and it was only really when it came to the civil rights marches at the end of the 60s and started to become exposed to, well, all of what was going on. And then the reaction to that there, as was pointed out there, the reaction even prior to Bloody Sunday when 14 people were killed, what you had in the north of Ireland was a Special Powers Act, which even when the apartheid regime was operating in South Africa, they were envious of the powers that the Special Powers Act had in the north of Ireland. You had not only the RUC, which was the police force, which at that stage was 97% Protestant, so it was from one community, but you also had a special armed militia called the D-Specials, which again were just really thugs in uniform. So you were talking about a fairly highly controlled, highly militarized situation. And the other thing is internment, right, which I suppose really highlighted it for myself. Internment without trial meant that really people were simply arrested and put in prison. There was no trial. There was no access to lawyers. And some people actually forget that this is Britain, so-called sort of mother of democracies, that was operating in its own internment camps for 4 years in the early 70s in this part of the world. So maybe those things give us sort of a flavour to the type of society I was growing up in, and then the reaction to it and the response by Irish Republicans.
Right. So can you tell us a little bit about how you decided to join the Republican movement? I mean, you were at a pretty young age, right?
I was 17 when I joined the IRA. As most people were, I suppose, fairly young. It was a sort of, I think, a process of seeing other people ending up in prison, of becoming more and more interested in what was happening, exposure to the news accounts, newspapers. But I suppose, I think for me, and it's always difficult to say what was the turning point or the straw that broke the camel's back, but I remember being regularly stopped, myself and just friends, coming back from playing football, coming back from dances and alcohol, and being stopped by what was a new militia, actually in the Ulster Defence Regiment, which its members have been responsible for loads of murders since then and various other activities.
Right.
And suddenly realising, I think at one point, that there was one faction of the community that was armed, that had the power to go out and stop me and harass me, to beat me, till take me to the local police station or whatever else. And I think that was the turning point that I decided that I just couldn't stand back any longer and went out. I felt I had to become involved.
I've talked to many people who grew up in that time period. It was very common to have neighbors arrested, family members arrested, being interned and things like this, and a lot of street rioting and that. Can you give us a flavor for the times that we're talking about there, right around internment preceding Bloody Sunday in 72?
Yeah, we're just talking, I mean, it is trying to imagine a situation where it's very, very, I mean, the north of Ireland is a very small country, a very small part of Ireland even, and Ireland itself isn't big. They were talking about probably 20,000 British soldiers on top of the other RUC, which was grossly disproportionate to the population, and then this other armed militias, the B Specials, which, when they got rid of them, they brought in the other Ulster Defence Regiment. It's probably just a very heavy military society where, and by that stage, by in 72-73, which is whenever I joined the movement, you were talking about just regular gun battles with British soldiers, particularly 1972. I think it's about 300 odd people killed, which again is a very small area, so you're talking about the intensity is very high. People you've been at school have been arrested and interned with. So it's not a normal society, put it that way.
Right.
And especially after Bloody Sunday in Derry, I think people might be expecting something major to happen in terms of the whole state collapsing.
Right. Fairly quickly, you ended up in prison after joining the IRA at age 17. How many years was it before you found your way into British prison?
I joined there in 17. That was in 1973. The following year, I ended up, because of the operations that I was involved in, I ended up having to leave my home when I was still 17. And for the next 2 years, I was busy what we would call here on the run.
I was
just dead in other safe houses. And that's the thing about here, and I suppose it's maybe want to lead into it, the whole thing about criminalisation, but
right.
I mean, IRA is one of the oldest guerrilla armies in the world, probably. I think it's one of the most professional, despite all of the attempts by the British government, and sometimes the Irish government, mm-hmm. to crush them. The thing that has sustained them is that they have the support of the people. Without the support of the people, without people prepared to put us up in their houses, give us their cars, feed us, clothes, watch out for us, the IRA could never have existed. And it's the thing that, and I've shown again, particularly in the prison struggle,
right.
that basically on the ground, people believed in the justice of the struggle that the IRA was waging. So it was for 2 years I existed not there, and then in August 1976, which was a particularly special year, I ended up being arrested from actually from my own home that I'd come to visit, but that night I ended up in prison.
Can you walk us through some of the stages that developed into the hunger strikes, but that concerning the prison struggle?
Yeah. Whenever I went in August, that had been several months after the introduction of the new policy, which was that from the 1st of March 1976, the recognition of political status was removed to be regarded as common criminals. And what that meant was that once you'd be sentenced, and remember, sentenced in a court that doesn't have any jury, it's a special court, there's only one judge. No jury. It was called Diplock Courts after the Lord Diplock, who established these courts, which basically just rubber stamped people as they were processed through interrogation centres, where again you were held for 7 days and no access to lawyers or anything. A lot of torture, brutality. Actually, the police doctor who was based at the police station resigned and went public. A bit like what you get now, the exposure about what's happening in Iraq by American soldiers and ill treatment of prisoners. This doctor came out and publicized it all, so it's not like Republican propaganda, but the brutality and torture that went on. But you ended up in court and then sentenced. By that stage, they had built part of a new prison called the Heach Blocks. The Heach Blocks of Long Cash. Long Cash had existed prior to that as the internment camp. But they built these new blocks called Heach because of the shape of them. And what was meant to be, what the policy laid out, was that once you were sentenced in this special court, you'd be taken to these Heach Blocks and you'd wear a prison uniform and you'd do prison work and you would basically behave as an ordinary prisoner. And I suppose for us, I mean, I was 19 at that time, and that was the average age. So there's people in prison 17, 18, 19, probably the oldest is about 21, 22. Very young, fairly politically naive, I have to say, at that time. Unsure of really what we would do other than that we would not agree to abide by this new law, this new legislation. So when the first person was sentenced in September 1976, Ciarán Nugent, he was taken to the Heach Blocks. He was stripped of his own clothes. He was told to put on a prison uniform and he refused. And he was held naked for 3 days in a cell, and then finally he was given a blanket. He put the blanket around him, and that began what became known as the blanket protest.
And how many people participated in these blanket protests? Are we talking about a handful of prisoners, and how many are we talking about?
No, we're probably at the head of it, there's probably about 450 Republicans. There would always have been about 300. Ciarán was the first one. By the time I was sentenced, I was actually the 100th prisoner sentenced to joined it, which was in April the following year, 1977. And it just continued to build. Because of the type of protest, as I said, we were naked, we were in a cell all the time. It's easier to say what you didn't have, or what we had. We had a piece of sponge for a mattress, we had a container for water, and we had a piss pot and a Bible, right, in the cell, and that was it. We didn't get out of the cell for exercise, didn't have TV, radios, or access to books or anything. For a 5-year period, up until the end of the second hunger strike in 1981.
Wow. And then how did the blanket protest end up into the no-wash protest?
I mean, the numbers built up from September 1976. I think the prison authorities were amazed that the protest was continuing. I mean, I think, again, it showed that they just had never, I suppose the British had never had any understanding of Irish history, and certainly of Irish Republicans, and how they respond. And actually, if you look back in Irish history, like prison protest is something that's very common. Actually, the blanket protest that happened prior to us going on it, it happened particularly after 1916, after the Easter Rising in Dublin. So the same protest took place through different centuries, through different decades, which would make you think that the British might have learned something along the way, but didn't. So the protest continued to increase in numbers. And as it did, there was then, I think, initiated a fairly intensive period of brutality to try to break up prisoners. At that time, we were allowed to go out to have a shower twice a week and have access to the toilets, and people were getting harassed and raped and searched. We were allowed to go to that time with a towel on us, but we've been strip searched. People have been severely beaten coming on to the protest, and we started, without any clear idea of where it was going, a policy of withdrawing all cooperation, and we said we were refusing to wash or brush it ourselves until we got an end to this harassment.
Right.
And the response again of the prison authorities was very brutal. They came and took out all the furniture we had in the cells. They removed all our facilities from us, which was toilet facilities and such like. And within a period of a few days, we were left, and at that time, no option. We were using the cells as toilets. And as a way to actually get rid of excrement, we were thrown out of the windows initially. It was been thrown back in again by prison officers. And our sort of solution to all of this was actually to smear the walls of the prison cell with the excrement. And it's what became known as, for us, became the no-wash protest, because that's where we were starting from, with the policy of refusing to wash. It was described by the British as a dirty protest, which again put a different connotation on it, but it arose out of, as I say, an action and reaction by us and the prison authorities. It continued over, from that period onwards. People like Cardinal O'Fee, who was at that time the Catholic Primate of All Ireland, and he was a nationalist, he was from Crossmaglen, South Armagh, which is a fairly Republican area, but he was also a historian. He was very much aware of the whole Irish history, very much involved with the GAA, and he was a regular visitor to the jail, and I suppose for us made a very beneficial statement after he had left. In one of his visits, he said that what he had witnessed was worse than what he had seen in the streets of Calcutta in India. That nobody should be forced to live in this way here, that it was unbelievable that this situation did exist. And thereafter, he became very much involved as trying to be an intermediary between the Northern Ireland office and the prison authorities and ourselves. But despite all of the attempts he made, it didn't come to anything, and the hunger strike was the last thing we were left with. And again, hunger strike and history of Irish republicanism, and certainly in the history of prisons, is again something that's very much a prominent feature.
Can you share with our listeners what were the demands that the IRA prisoners were asking for from the British system?
This is what we wanted. This is, I suppose, a contradiction. It actually existed still at that time. Anybody who had been sentenced in court prior to March 1976 still retained the right to be treated as a political prisoner. And what that meant was wear their own clothes, didn't have to do prison work, could organise their own education, their own daily lives, and would be housed together according to their own political affiliation. And that's basically what our demands were. We had a list of five demands, which was the right to wear our own clothes, the right not to do prison work, to have access to education. The others was basically, you know, to have access to visits and letters once a month.
Wow.
And the return of the remission that we had lost during the period of protest. So, I mean, they're fairly basic demands in that sense.
This is KPFK 90.7 FM. With us on the line is Dr. Lawrence McEwen, former hunger striker and author of Out of Time, Irish Republican Prisoner in Longkesh. And you were just talking about that the blanket protest and the no-wash protest led into trying to basically step it up a bit to reach your demands, and you said you're moving into the hunger strikes. Can you talk a little bit about your decision to join the hunger strike? Because as I understand from your book, you had already watched four of your comrades pass away.
Well, I had been on the protest from when I was sentenced. At that stage, I was 24 years of age. I was totally committed to the protest. I believed that we were correct to be involved in it. I couldn't envisage a situation where I would just meekly wear a prison uniform and in a sense, say I was a criminal, which, as again, as you pointed out earlier, was meant to criminalize the whole Republican struggle, the whole resistance. So I believed very much in the whole protest. I believed that we had exhausted every possible avenue. And it has to be remembered that during that time, people became both physically ill and mentally ill. A number of prisoners then stayed, including the person who joined it first, Kieran Nugent, just through illness in later years. Some actually just went mad, to be quite blunt about it. So there were conditions that we just couldn't maintain that type of protest indefinitely. So there was an urgency. I mean, it's one of those situations where you can never fully say what way you're going to respond in the final days, but I think that stage, given the type of experiences I had been through both on the outside and inside particularly, that I felt that I could go through with it. I had put my name down prior to the hunger strike starting. You never knew whether you were going to be picked or not. There was the person who was the officer commanding the prisoners. Brendan McFarlane was the person responsible for selecting names. So even by the time it came to me joining the hunger strike, by which time four people had died, my opinion hadn't changed at all, felt it was necessary. I think it was a period whenever, and this is the other thing sometimes people find very strange, that Bobby Sands, whose anniversary occurs next week and was the first prisoner to die, was actually elected a member of the British Parliament at Westminster while he was a prisoner. Given that the whole issue was about criminalisation, given that Maggie Thatcher, who was the Tory Prime Minister at that time, was saying that Republican prisoners were criminals, and then one of them got elected to the Parliament, actually got elected with more votes than Maggie Thatcher ever got. For any sort of sane person or person looking at the situation objectively would have said, well, it couldn't possibly be criminals if people are electing them
to
be the Member of Parliament. I suppose when the hunger strike started, we were very gloomy about it. Then Bobby was elected. We thought that our hopes soared. And the only response that the British government did was to immediately introduce legislation to ensure that once Bobby died, no other prisoner could stand. So I think, and then Bobby died, and Frank Hughes and Remnant Patty immediately after him. So I think there's still a very strong bit, and I'd always felt it, of determination. So I suppose, long story short, by the time I joined it, my opinions had hardened, my convictions had hardened from the time that I actually initially volunteered to join the hunger strike.
Lawrence, how does an IRA prisoner get elected into British Parliament? What did it look like? How did the organizing look? Walk us through that process.
Well, I mean, all of it, we'd have been very much in contact with the Republican movement on the outside, and Sinn Féin, which at that time existed as a party, but to be quite honest, was basically irrelevant in many ways. Sinn Féin didn't take part in election. Today, they're now the largest political party on the nationalist side of the community, of which Gerry Adams is the president. So it was in contact with people on the outside, and I suppose we're very, in some sense, fortuitous that the opportunity arose because the sitting MP, who had been very much in support of our demands, called Frank McGuire from Fermanagh, he died. He visited the prison several times in the past. He had spoken out in support of our demands. He died, and an opportunity arose for a by-election, and at that time, prisoners could actually stand in elections. Again, it's very popular in Ireland. People who, down through the decades or centuries even, have been elected members of Parliament while in prison. Because imprisonment is a very political thing in Ireland, it's been used just as a means of coercion by the British while they've been here. So, literally, Bobby Sands could stand for election. There was an opportunity there because the sitting MP had died. And the Republican movement on the outside, and particularly Gerry Adams, and that threw their weight fully behind the whole campaign. Which is the thing about it, that the hunger strike probably initiated a rapid growth within Sinn Féin on the outside. And later led on to all of those electoral successes in very short years afterwards. So at that time, the prisoners could actually stand for an action, and it was organised on the outside, again, by many ex-prisoners, but also other members of the Republican movement.
Just so people get a sense, what was the international support for this movement? And I understand there were about 50,000 people here in New York protesting and all around the world and in Iran, right in front of the British embassy, the street named after Bobby Sands.
Yeah, I mean, there's a campaign at the moment by the current British Foreign Secretary appealing to Iran to change the street name because it is the British embassy is situated in Bobby Sands Street. But yes, I mean, international support at that time was just Arabic. The Indian Parliament had a minute silence, as did the Portuguese Parliament. You had the longshore workers in America refusing to handle cargo going onto British ships or coming off them. South Africa, Fidel Castro spoke out at the United Nations, and again the other year opened a memorial plot to hunger strikers as did South Africa and also Mandela again. And again, there's been all these big links with South Africa and the struggle there. And actually, in the later years, delegations from the ANC visited the jail after the whole ceasefires. Probably just because the Irish struggle, as an anti-colonial struggle, is known as that. The people that would have been struggling against the British presence have had a presence in many other parts of the world, including your own part. So there's always been, either very overt or something like covert support for what's been going on in Ireland. So and I think because people couldn't understand why it was someone like the tunnel of British Parliament, like that as an MP, but then have to die in prison because he was asking could he wear his own clothes. It resonates very much with the things that have happened in the past in Ireland. Terence McSweeney, who's the Lord Mayor of Dublin, same thing, 1923, just imprisoned without trial and went on hunger strike and died just to be released. I think it's because of the nature of the Irish struggle that it tapped into a nerve with oppressed people throughout the world.
So once again, you're listening to KPFK 90.7 here on Voices from the Frontlines. We're talking with Dr. Lawrence McCune, who was an Irish hunger striker in 1981. This week marks the 23rd anniversary of Bobby Sands' death on that hunger strike. He was the first of 10 hunger strikers to die that week. So one of the things I'm particularly interested in is those international links and the support within the movement in Ireland. Over the years, as I've visited Ireland, I've been impressed with the support for other anti-imperialist and anti-racist struggles and how you see that as a component part to your own struggle there, seeing the wall murals, everything from Palestine and South Africa to Mumia Abu Jamal, which is close to our hearts here in the United States. I'm just curious if you could speak to some of the political education that you were helping to coordinate within the prisons for the prisoners in terms of the way you looked at other liberation struggles.
First of all, like Irish republicanism isn't a narrow philosophy or ideology. One part of it is Irish nationalism, which is about the right to rule our own lives as Ireland, free from British presence. But the other central tenet of Irish republicanism is internationalism, anti-sectarianism, not just non, but actually anti, and you could say anti-racist, socialist. So in that sense, we're immediately sort of disposed towards any other liberation struggles and liberation people. And as you say, I think the murals, the wall murals in Belfast and Derry particularly highlight that, I think, from what you've mentioned there, Palestine, South Africa, Nicaragua. I mean, at the moment, they've had a highly publicized trial going on in Colombia where two of them, ex-prisoners, Republican ex-prisoners, but three Republicans, were accused of helping to train the park guerrillas. You know, so there's an interest which arises simply from once you understand that colonialism and imperialism isn't an isolated, it's not just your own country, it's the fact that it's a global phenomenon. So therefore, and I can't remember the exact quote, and at the moment, but Che Guevara had a brilliant quote out there, like there's no longer any small wars because, I mean, what they're up against, the global nature of it. So because we're our type of politics of what we were striving for, we were very interested. I mean, I know like I was actually in prison when I first learned about Cuba and then later on learned about its struggle. And then once we did get access to books following the ending of the hunger strike and getting out of Mon, I mean, our focus was on, at that time, particularly struggles in Zimbabwe, Mozambique, Angola, that whole era, obviously South Africa itself, but then go back to Algiers and all the rest of it. So we, I suppose there was a period of time where we literally deferred books. People who had been writing something in particular, there was like Franz Fanon, Wretched of the Earth, talking about the whole situation there. Or someone who was a real influence for us in our education system was Paulo Freire, who was a Brazilian educationist. So I suppose we're very eclectic in a way, but anyone who was writing about liberation, anybody who had a story to tell about their experiences of that, we created a very, I think, a very comprehensive education system, which was not just academic, people did academic studies, but also very much about personal self-development, personal knowledge, current affairs, history, economics, Marxism, all about creating a very critical understanding. And I think a lot of that has now been evidenced on the outside because as people got out of prison, they immediately became re-involved and re-engaged in the struggle, very often in a political way, in becoming elected representatives. If you look at Sinn Féin, probably most of its upper leadership and middle leadership are ex-prisoners. And it's not just about, I suppose, the reading and education, but the bond, the solidarity that grows up within the prison, the trust through countless struggles that then has passed on the outside and a new way of doing things and, I suppose, new energy.
So finally, I wanted to touch a little bit on the state of the struggle today. I know that this peace process that the IRA has been engaging with from the British has been going on for quite a long time now. And in that time, the Sinn Féin, the political party of the Irish Liberation Movement, has eclipsed the Social Democratic Party to become the main voice of nationalism in Ireland today. So I'm just curious about any thoughts you have on the direction of the movement today.
Well, I think the struggle itself has developed very rapidly, and certainly in terms of the political party, it has definitely developed very rapidly. I think very much assisted by the whole prison struggle, and as I say, the ex-prisoners are very prominent in the Sinn Féin. I think it's probably reflective of ex-prisoners and Republicans in general that the armed struggle had brought us, I think it was necessary. I think it's unfortunate that that was the case, but I think that struggle would never have been our cause, would never have been highlighted, would never have the profile it had if there hadn't been an armed struggle for that period of time. I think that once an opportunity was opened up, as it was around the early 90s, initiated again, which often has to be pointed out by Republicans.
Right.
It was them who were always constantly like, okay, making the war, but also striving for the peace. But peace with justice, not peace at any price. And then when that space was opened up, probably discredited by Tony Blair, as opposed to when the Conservatives had been in power by Maggie Thatcher, then you were able to move into a political process where there could be discussion. And I think there was very high hope at one time. I think that has tailed off somewhat because after the Good Friday Agreement, which was a major compromise on the part of Republicans, accepting the existence of the Northern State until such times as the majority of people would desire to change it. That was a major compromise by Republicans, but one that they were prepared to work with. And a number of other things. There was meant to be change in the policing. There was meant to be demilitarization. There was meant to be cross-border institutions established. A lot of this hasn't happened. So there's a lot of frustration, I think, in the Republican community. Not with Republicans, I suppose I have to point out, but with unionists. And I think what our experience has taught us, and my organization, the ex-prison organization, is involved with a lot of outreach and contact with people in the unionist community.
For our listeners who are interested in your organization, can you give us a website for people to get in touch with you?
Yes, it's www.coiste.ie.
So again, that was www.coiste.ie. Thank you so much for joining us today. We have Dr. Lawrence McEwen. He's the author of Out of Time, Irish Republican Prisoner in Longkesh, 1972 to 2000, which is published by Beyond the Pale. You know, this last question was just throwing it out to you. We should definitely have you on for another show to talk about the current conditions in Ireland.
Thanks very much, Lawrence.
Okay, thank you.
So we're going to go out right now with a song titled The Ballad of Mairead Farrell. Mairead was actually the commanding officer of the IRA in Armagh Women's Prison, and she led some of the women's prisoners in the first hunger strike. Released from prison, she resumed her active service with the IRA and was assassinated by the British in 1988.
Do not stop.
For joining us this week. We'd like to thank our guests, Will Cordery and Stephanie Gilyou from Project South, and Dr. Lawrence McEwen from Coistra in Belfast. Today we have music from Harold Melvin, Blue Tones, and Shanahi. Please let us know what you think about the show. You can call us at 213-387-2800 or email us at comments@kpfk.org. Like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our engineers, Mark Maxwell, Stan Misrahi, and Maggie LaPique. Stay tuned, because coming up next, we have Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman. She's going to be talking to Robert McChesney about his new book, The Problem of the Media, followed up by labor activists celebrating May Day and working class heroes. It's coming up next.